The American consumer is holding up this economy, but will inflation make us hold back on holiday spending? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams, in for Kai Rizdal. It's Friday, November 25th. Good to have you with us. For those who had a day off yesterday, I hope you had a restful holiday. But for American retailers, we are entering the busiest time of the year. And for more on the state of economic affairs this Black Friday, I'm joined by Sudeep Reddy at Politico and Jordan Holman at the New York Times. Welcome, you two.
Hi, Kimberly.
Hey.
So, Jordan, let me start with you. What are you expecting to see this retail holiday season?
So no one really quite knows what to make of this holiday shopping season. There's a lot of noise with different data points when it comes to, will people pull back because of inflation, or do they see this as a last hurrah, so they're going to spin. But we do have some estimates. So the National Retail Federation expects retail sales to increase 6 to 8%. That's a nominal number. So also keeping in mind that inflation in the month of October was about 7.7%. So it might be a wash, I guess, essentially, to kind of look at the increase in sales. But one thing that we do know is it's probably going to be more of in-store shopping, which obviously department stores really benefit from, Target really benefits from. So we're just starting to see what that's shaping out to look like. We know people will spend. It's mostly a question of like on what and how much.
That's really interesting, Jordan, that they're expecting a lot more in-store shopping, which is a shift away from what we've been seeing the last few years.
Absolutely. So even today, when we think about Black Friday, today was probably the most normal type of Black Friday that we've had in the past 2 years, because there was a lot less restrictions when it came to in-store shopping. And then even when I was out earlier today, you did see like the groups of folks going out, you know, you have the matching t-shirts. It was more casual of browsing. You didn't have to mask up and wait in line. So I think there is that vibe of people wanting to just be out and about that doesn't necessarily translate to sales, but this is the time of year that retailers really capitalize on the experience.
Sudeep, in one of the Politico newsletter, they were talking about the silver lining in the recession cloud, that consumers actually have more savings still and that their spending habits haven't changed that much. How does that factor into this shopping season?
It means that consumers have a lot of dry powder right now. It's a lot of comfort that's sitting on in a lot of households. And that means that consumers might decide that they want to go and buy something right now, but also might decide to squirrel it away and save up for a rainy day. And that's an important factor now, because it means that we're not going to necessarily see these blowout periods when actually retailers are probably sitting on a lot of inventory that they had waiting in ships before coming over, and it finally all got over here, and now consumers aren't necessarily rushing out to buy. It's kind of a calmer consumer moment where people are going to sit around a while, wait and see what happens. But that means that it probably prolongs any arrival of a consumer recession, because people are going to be a little more comfortable and aren't necessarily going to be pulling back at the pace that you would have seen at another time if we didn't have that kind of household savings on deck right now.
Sudeep, I want to stick with you because I want to talk about supply chains, which have been such a huge factor the last few holiday seasons, either because things weren't arriving on time or you couldn't get anything, there was no stock. Now we have a potential rail strike coming. We have traffic slowed down on the Mississippi River. How much of an impact is this going to have on what we see on store shelves?
Yeah, the supply chain experts are definitely still in high demand these days. It's kind of confusing to have gone from the period when you couldn't get anything into our ports, and now there's too much sitting here, and then we could then like snap back with the rail strike, making it harder to get some even basic staples coming into our stores. That could unsettle the economy. There are obviously risks coming from China in the next few months with a return to COVID lockdowns that they're having again, and factories being shut down are going to make it harder to get for people to get their iPhones when they want them. All of this just really adds up to an extremely confusing picture of where things are, which is going to be unsettling for retailers if they feel like their spidey sense is suggesting there might be a slowdown ahead. They want to get rid of whatever they've got on their shelves, but they also could look ahead and say, oh gosh, there could be another round of supply chain misery ahead, and no one wants to deal with that.
Jordan, this rail strike could potentially be really significant. Reuters says this could freeze almost 30% of all U.S. cargo shipments and cost the American economy as much as $2 billion per day. And the unions rejected a deal negotiated with the help of the Biden administration on Monday. What are you hearing from retailers about how concerned they are about this?
It's all about contingency plans. I think what Sadiq was saying earlier about that calculation of do I buy more now? Could people be like more constrained in their spending? Like the calculation of the rail strike and all that disruption is definitely going in there for the retailers. Mostly when I'm talking to executives, they really are holding back on guidance for the year ahead because they just don't know what January and February might look like when it comes to spending, when it comes to how you get your stuff to the stores and how much people will want. And I think just the other element of it is there's not a clear shift of where that capacity could go. It's not necessarily that like trucking could take all of that, move all of those goods that railroads move, or like airlines are really expensive for them. So it is still like this wait and see, the classic phrase that executives usually use, but there's no clear cut path forward.
So much more to say about this, but we'll have to do it another time. That was Jordan Holman at the New York Times and Sadiq Reddy at Politico. Thanks, you two.
Thanks, Kimberly.
Thanks.
On Wall Street today, a short trading day for the holiday. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. So yes, the big economic story of the day is indeed Black Friday. We shop, and before we stop, we pull out our wallet to pay. And these days, many of us are doing that with the credit card of one kind or another. During the pandemic, with stimulus payments and fewer ways to spend our money, many consumers just paid down debt. But now we're spending more on stuff again, all while prices are going up. What all this means is that consumer debt levels are rising again, and as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, that could cause some problems for this year's holiday spending and the wider economy going forward.
Americans' credit card balances are up 15% from a year ago, according to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. It's the biggest increase in more than 20 years. Consumer debts now back up to pre-pandemic levels, and loan delinquencies are on the rise.
Consumers are getting a bit over their skis at this point from a consumer credit perspective.
Sam Stovall is chief investment strategist at CFRA Research. He says a key economic warning sign is when debt rises to more than 20% of personal income. We're now above 25%.
Such an elevated debt-to-income ratio in the face of high inflation and a softening economy, I think, will make it hard for consumers to maintain, let alone raise, this level of spending.
As inflation bites, consumers are shifting what they're spending on, says Cheryl Kingstone at S&P Global Market Intelligence.
A lot of it is necessities. Spending is now going to what we call non-discretionary.
Meaning more on groceries, utilities, and rent, less on presents and going out during the holidays. And some consumers who are strapped for cash are running down their savings and racking up debt even to afford the basics, says Robert Frick at Navy Federal Credit Union.
Unfortunately, most lower-income people have paid their savings down completely. And there's still $1.5 trillion in excess savings but that's kind of sequestered among higher income people.
As consumer debt rises, so does the cost of paying it back, because interest rates are rising too. So far, though, consumers are still in okay shape for one key reason, says former Fed economist Claudia Sahm.
The job market is really good.
She says if unemployment rises and consumers are caught with high debt and no income, that could spell more economic trouble to come. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Next week, we'll get a trove of new economic data, with multiple reports coming out full of clues on everything from where inflation and consumer morale are headed to how the job market is holding up. Marketplace's Savannah Marr asked some analysts and economists about what they'll be looking for in all that data.
The last Tuesday of the month means we'll get a measure of consumer confidence. The Conference Board won't just tell us about consumers' current mood, but also their economic outlook and whether they're planning to make big purchases in the coming months. Recently, that monthly data has revealed some pessimism.
If those numbers fall further, it suggests that retailers may not have the happiest of holidays.
Says David Garfield, Global Head of Industries for Alex Partners.
And that consumer confidence remains suppressed with fears of inflation.
Which we'll get a measure of from the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, the Federal Reserve's preferred inflation snapshot out Thursday. Jennifer Lee, a senior economist with BMO Capital Markets, will be poring over that data.
Looking at particularly wages and salaries.
Whether they can support continued spending amid inflation and whether consumer spending patterns are shifting.
I always look at those discretionary items. You know, are people still going out for lunch, for dinner, going out for a drink after work with colleagues, for example? If consumers were truly, truly worried, that would be one of the first areas that they will cut back on.
We'll also get some data from the Labor Department, starting with the Job Openings and Labor Turnover Survey. Elise Gould with the Economic Policy Institute is interested in the turnover part.
And the kind of churn that we've been seeing in the labor market as people have quit their jobs in search of better ones.
And whether layoffs are extending beyond the tech sector. On Friday, Gould says the November jobs report will tell us whether the Fed's rate hikes are having a cooling effect on the job market.
I do want to look at what is happening for different demographic groups.
Like Black and Native American workers, who tend to fare worse during economic slowdowns. Even with all that data getting released, David Garfield with Alex Partners has his eye on another indicator.
The real monster under the bed is the rail strike.
He says whether it comes to pass could tell us a lot more about where the economy is headed. I'm Savannah Marr for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we raise tuition slightly
inside the essential business of childcare. But first, let's do the numbers. The markets had a short session today on account of Black Friday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 152 points, 0.4%, finishing at 34,347. The Nasdaq dropped 58 points, 0.5%, to close at 11,226. And the S&P 500 shed 1 point, staying flat, to end at 4026. We just heard from Mitchell Hartman that consumers seem to be more financially stressed and carrying debt, but with wages up, they're still spending. Macy's was up almost 1%, Kohl's lost 1.7%, Nordstrom gained 2%. And if not shopping, many people are eating leftovers today. But Feeding America, a nonprofit that oversees more than 200 food banks, says more than three quarters of those food banks have reported increased or steady demand since summer, along with rising food prices. Bonds fell, the yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.69%, and you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. The country of Greenland is on the front lines of climate change. About 80% of the world's largest island is covered in ice, which is melting a lot faster than scientists would hope. Arctic temperatures have risen faster in Greenland than anywhere else in the world. Now, for local communities, a warmer climate has helped industries like fishing in the short term, but many fear what the future holds. The BBC's Adrian Murray visited the coastal town of Ilulissat to find out more.
As Gallerik Mathiasson heads out in his boat to haul in the day's halibut catch, towering white and blue icebergs the size of city blocks loom through the mist. He's been fishing here in Disko Bay for decades.
This is your soulmate.
Each season is not how it used to be. Over the years, I especially noticed that the icebergs have been getting smaller and weaker.
In winter, he used to fish with his sled dogs. But he says that's too dangerous now, that the sea ice no longer freezes like it used to.
Here in Ilulissat, there's a constant soundtrack of sled dogs howling and barking. 2 decades ago, there were 5,000 of them in this town. Now, though, there's only 1,800.
Fleming and Annesvi Lawrenson run winter dog sledding tours over the surrounding snow-covered tundra.
I'm not happy to see the dogs disappearing from our culture. I want to preserve the culture that my father had.
The season is getting shorter and shorter. We can feel that.
Fleming points to a map on the wall and shows me how much the nearby Semak Koshok or Jakobsand Glacier has retreated.
You can see there's a big piece of the glacier missing there. All this ice is missing now.
Each year, hundreds of thousands of cubic feet of ice is carved from the glacier's mouth about 30 miles away. And as more ice melts, it's flowing faster and sending more icebergs into the bay. Skillfully weaving around these floating giants, Gjord Jonathansson is a skipper on a tour boat. Even young people like him have witnessed change within their lifetimes.
Nowadays, we never know how the winter is going to be. I think this year has been unusual compared to the others. And a lot of places in Greenland have records in rain.
In many ways, Arctic life has become easier. For now, retreating sea ice has brought new opportunities. In the harbour, even bigger catches are being unloaded. It's now possible to fish year-round by boat, and Ilulissat is booming. Palladra Myerson is the mayor of the local Avannaata district.
We are thinking about the climate changes. We can feel it every day. We can see it every day. There are some negative things. There are also some positive things. Our fishermen take our boats and fish all the winter. But up in the north, used to take some long hunting tours. They can't do it anymore, so they have to change their way of living.
Research by the Universities of Greenland and Copenhagen, carried out before the COVID-19 pandemic, found that 3/4 of Greenlanders felt that climate change had already impacted their lives. And just recently, a group of climate scientists warned that major sea level rise is inevitable. Alan Hubbard is a glaciologist and climate scientist at the Arctic University of Norway.
At the moment, it's a system that's in deficit. The amount of snow falling in it can't keep up with the melt and the iceberg calving. What I've come to understand in the last 10 years is that there are really, really abrupt changes going on.
Today, Greenland's melting ice may be having a big impact close to home, but is only adding a fraction of an inch to global sea levels. However, scientists say these losses are taking place faster than expected, and they'll have serious consequences for coastal communities far away from here. I'm the BBC's Adrian Murray for Marketplace.
Coming Coming back to the U.S., the number of American workers who said they'd missed work because of childcare problems rose to an all-time high last month, according to data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And despite all the attention over the past few years, the childcare industry still has about 88,000 fewer workers than before the pandemic. For the next installment of our series, My Economy, the story of one daycare center in Buffalo and how it's changed.
My name is Dasha Natalinsky, and I work as the cook and a worker owner at the Rose Garden Early Childhood Center. My mother is the founder, so the Rose in Rose Garden is from my grandma's name, and it's also my middle name, so there's lots of family connection. But it also felt important to me personally to bring it into this co-op structure. In the spring of 2020, we did shut down for about a month, I believe, and this was to put in place COVID safety requirements. But we reopened for the summer, and the workload was bigger than it used to be in a place where it always is a hard workload in early childcare. With much of the staff gone or leaving, our best option was to close with plans to reopen if we could train and staff properly and, most importantly, get a director.
My name is Shay Akers. I was brought on as part of the new generation, so to speak. Jokingly, I would say that I was an archaeologist. I spent a lot of my time going through our files and our organization. A lot of my job was to figure out ways to retain employees. In Buffalo, New York, a living wage is $17.49 an hour, and that became our base pay. We raised tuition slightly, and we also committed to a plan of raising prices every 3 years. We had some pushback for it. I would like it to be more accessible in regards to low income, and we have thought about various ways we can do that, whether it is with New York State or federal social services. But we don't want our staff to have to be doing two or three jobs and sacrifice their lives or their families. We picked September 6th to be our first day and reopened.
It felt very triumphant to be back and open and have kids here and hear children's voices. All of it felt like a return to what once was and also what we had been working so hard for.
That was Dasha Natalinsky and Shay Akers in Buffalo, New York. You can tell us about your economy at marketplace.org. We've done a lot of retail news today, so for this final note on the way out, let's switch gears and talk about something else folks have been doing this holiday week besides shopping: watching the World Cup. According to online sports magazine The Athletic, for the U.S.-Wales match, which ended in a draw on Monday, Fox said the broadcast averaged just over 8.3 million viewers, up to more than 9.4 million in the final minutes of the game. Telemundo, a division of NBC, which owns the rights to air the World Cup in the U.S. with Spanish commentary, averaged about 3.4 million viewers. The Athletic also mentions that Fox is expecting today's U.S.-England match to be the most watched men's soccer game in U.S. television history. Here's your moment of economic context. In case you're curious, the cost of tickets to those World Cup games, according to NBC Sports, ranges from as low as $11 for not the best seats in some of the early matches and can easily get to upwards of $1,000 for a better seat in the finals. Of course, that's not including getting there, lodging, food, and whatever World Cup swag you might want to buy if you're there in person. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kimberly Adams. We will see you on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.